Well, it's a big weekend, as we all know. Midori is coming to town. This great violinist appearing with two orchestras. Yours is one. And the Junior Symphony must be beside themselves with excitement.
We've been giddy about it all year, and it's scarcely to be believed that it's finally time that she's here.
What do you think of when you consider working with a great soloist like Midori?
Well, I mean, I suppose the first thing in my head is just sort of the extraordinary wealth of experiences she's had on the world stage and the sort of connections she's made throughout the musical world to idols of mine, idols of all of us, as she herself is, of course. She, of course, was a real child prodigy, so she started her career very, very young. She was already on the world's most prominent stages as a very young girl, really. And, there's a great video even and it's sort of a legendary story of her playing at Tanglewood and with a Boston Symphony Orchestra, and Leonard Bernstein was conducting. So right there, you know, you imagine that she's just, you know, when she was still a child, Bernstein was still in the final years of his conducting. You know, this was someone I've always admired, but never had a chance to see live. So that's an amazing connection. And this concert is just legendary because she apparently broke a string on her violin and had to use the concertmaster's violin, broke a string on that violin and had to use the assistant concertmaster's violin, but kept dutifully, I mean, I think she was 11 at the time, but kept dutifully going on and finished the concerto. I think it might have been Mendelssohn, to, of course, rapturous applause and great enthusiasm from the orchestra. And even Bernstein getting down on his knees on the podium and sort of bowing to her as, you know, just a giant already of music. So what an incredible story to imagine, and to think that this person who's been connected with such great figures is herself such a legendary figure will be sharing the stage with us, not only musically, I mean, it's exciting, of course, in that pure sense, but also in terms of what we might gather from her, what, you know, what ins and outs and sort of special degrees of knowledge she knows about what it is to perform really on the world's great stages.
And her days of being a child prodigy are long over.
True.
And as a mature woman, she has turned to reaching out and working, especially with young people. And this is part of her mission, is coming to Kalamazoo and working with the Junior Symphony.
That's exactly right. I mean, not only is she, of course, she still plays on many of the world's great stages, but she devotes a significant amount of her life as just a teacher to some really great violin students. In fact, one of our Stolberg bronze medalists who came to play with the orchestra, I think it was last year, his name is Vince Meklis. He's one of her students in California, where she primarily resides. I think she's got the Heifetz Chair of Music at UCLA, which is a pretty nice named chair to have. And so she does that kind of teaching. And then twice a year, professional orchestras and youth orchestras in towns that want to kind of gain from her expertise and her thinking and ways about maybe in which they might be able to make music more compellingly, more engagingly to a wider audience, try to ask her for this residency. And, the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony in conjunction with the Kalamazoo Symphony applied for this last year, and we got some encouraging words back, but it didn't win, and then it finally worked this year. How beautifully on the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony's 75th anniversary. So we just couldn't be happier, and we're so excited to have her in town and to learn from her and really to see, when she does these residencies, they're not for very many days, but boy, does she commit fully to doing whatever she can in those times. I mean, she's asked us to really book her. She doesn't even really want lunch times. You know, she just wants to go from morning till night, you know, just give whatever you've got. You know, she'll be there and energetically rolling up her sleeves and giving all that she has. So we're really excited to see what all this brings.
You'll be happy to know that this was announced nationally yesterday during performance today. Fred Child played a performance of Midori's that happened recently and then mentioned her residency in Kalamazoo with the Junior Symphony and the KSO.
Terrific. I missed that. That's wonderful news.
Well, we will talk a little more about Midori a little later in the hour, but let's look at the whole program you've scheduled for Sunday. It's at 4 o'clock at Chenery Auditorium, as always, and this is a really fun concert. I can imagine this might be one where the kids can't get certain melodies out of their heads.
I think that's right. Yes, I've managed to choose primarily two composers who are two of the greatest tunesmiths, I think, in music history. So primarily, you know, in negotiations with Midori's manager, we talked about what she might be able to play here, and he said, you know, well, she can always play the third, the finale of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. And I thought, well, that's an all right piece of music. That sounds pretty good to us. So I started thinking from that vantage point, what might we build around it? And I thought, well, why not stay with Tchaikovsky there and do the Fourth Symphony, which is a piece that comes very much from that same time period. That's, of course, at the end of the program, so we'll return to Tchaikovsky in a second, but I started to think of other sort of sympathetic figures, and one that came to mind was Bizet, Georges Bizet, who's a French composer most famous for Carmen, of course, and Carmen was actually a piece that Tchaikovsky very much admired. Bizet died relatively young, so Tchaikovsky outlived him, but they were almost exact contemporaries, born, I think, only 2 years apart. And although Carmen, Bizet never lived to actually see Carmen become a great success on the stage. He really thought that it was just going to be a failure. Everyone was scandalized by the topics of the opera. And if you can believe it, there were some contemporary critics that accused it of being kind of tuneless, which seems just unthinkable to us now, right? Because, I mean, it's nothing but great tunes. But at any rate, I mean, this takes all kinds, right? So eventually, of course, Carmen did become very central repertory, very beloved, and Tchaikovsky very much admired this achievement and admired many of the other things that Bizet had done. And I think in a lot of ways there are some similarities between the composers in this sense that they both really used melody as a driving vehicle for their music. So what we're going to do this Sunday is actually the first suite from L'Alésienne, which is incidental music meant to accompany a play by Daudet. And it's sort of an interesting thing. Of course, this is music that is meant to sort of go in between and sometimes underneath spoken dialogue, which is something that had a form that had kind of fallen out of favor, but was being brought back, I guess, in mid-19th century Paris. But it's in many ways kind of a, I don't want to diminish it in any way, but perhaps a practice run for Carmen, because he deals with so many of the same themes in this music. It's essentially the story of this young man named Frédéric, who falls in love, hopelessly in love, with this girl from Arles. So hence the L'Alésienne, that just means girl from Arles. And the interesting thing is we never see this woman on the stage, apparently. She just never appears. She's just the beloved offstage somehow that
just
we're all supposed to assume.
Just talks about it.
Exactly, right. Apparently it's become a word in French, a sort of a snarky way of suggesting someone who you expect to see but doesn't ever show up. So he's in love with her. He finds out that she's actually the mistress to another man. He's devastated, absolutely devastated. But his family, including a very well-meaning but sort of simpleton, seems perhaps somewhat mentally challenged brother, sort of try and ease his pain, even though the brother doesn't quite know what's going on. It's obvious that he's a very loving and caring person. And eventually he sort of decides he will marry another woman. Everything's going to go all right. And then, of course, at the last minute, somebody says, oh, actually, I'm going to marry this L'Alésienne of yours. And he's plunged once again into despair and commits suicide. But this notion of love and loss, and of course the extremes that one can be driven to in the romantic imagination, are all themes that resonate again very strongly in Carmen. And I think Bizet really had a chance to sort of flex his dramatic muscles even in this music. So I thought perhaps we could listen to the just the first movement of this suite, which I think encapsulates a lot of these themes already. It really exists, this overture, in three distinct parts. The first part is a Provençal folk theme called the March of the Kings. It's just a wonderful, very stately, as you might imagine, for a March of Kings.
So it's a tune that already existed?
That's right. It's a tune that already existed. It was actually used, I think, as a Christmas carol in some ways, but it was, it's just a Provençal folk theme. And then he treats in a series of variations. The first one is stated very boldly and baldly. That is to say, it's not even harmonized. It's just the theme itself. It's a great march theme. Then there's a sort of slicker variant for just the woodwinds alone, a slightly more agitated, energetic one. a very languid one with the cellos and horns and bassoons playing this rather fun counterpoint. And then the sort of original statement comes back, but now fully harmonized. That's the first part of the overture. Then there's a really quite abrupt stop. And then we start, we're surprised by the sound of a saxophone, which was something that Bizet sometimes liked to use in the orchestra, but is not often heard in the orchestra. And this theme, this very beautiful sort of warm, loving, but also quite simple theme, is that of his brother, this sort of simple-minded fellow I was describing earlier. And then after this passes, we finally get the music of Frédéric himself. And that, you can see, is music of intense anguish. And all of a sudden, this overture takes a very dramatic turn in its last pages. And you can hear this incredible sense of yearning and tragedy as he grapples with his fate.
That's the opening overture to L'Alésienne by Georges Bizet, and it's on the program starting off the 4 o'clock show of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra this Sunday, a very special program, which is a collaboration with violinist Midori, and here at WMUK is conductor Andrew Kohler. I think of L'Alésienne, and I think of this is the piece that most people actually know a lot of the tunes to, but they have no idea what the title of the pieces.
That's a great point. There's another movement, which is also a folk song, called the Farandole, and this is not actually in the first suite. It was included in the second suite, so we won't be playing it this Sunday, but that's another piece that I would say is very fair to say that everyone sort of recognizes the tune, and it's one of those, you know, cartoony almost pieces of music, right? Somehow made it in, I think, into maybe some Looney Tunes cartoons, and it's in our collective consciousness, but isn't necessarily I immediately identified with Bizet, but it's really his treatment of these folk tunes that gave this particular set of incidental pieces its color, its characteristic color, I think, especially for audiences at the time, and just really lasted in some form in the musical imagination.
And it's one of the reasons I commented that this is the kind of program where you can't walk away without having a tune in your head, either by Bizet or Tchaikovsky.
That's true. These are definite earworms, but they're good. They're good ones, you know. I mean, you could do worse than to have this music stuck in your head, I think.
Well, I think time for full disclosure. I happen to be requested by yourself to sit and watch a whole afternoon of young people play their hearts out in concertos for the chance to play with Midori a few months ago now, I suppose.
Exactly right.
And it was so impressive. Teenagers appearing as soloists, as duos, and as trios. And I must say that the chore was very difficult. I'm not sure I want to be in that position again.
It can be tough. I know. I've been on the other side of that fence too, and it is tough. But to explain a little more fully, of course, we every year have a concerto competition for students within the orchestra. And, you know, this year, our 75th anniversary year worked out such that we had a Stolberg soloist, which we always have on our first concert, and then Midori on the second concert. And then in the spring, the Gilmore was very generous and helped arrange a wonderful pianist named Alan Goldstein to come play with us. So we thought, uh-oh, now where does a student soloist fit into all of this, right? I mean, it's going to be another concerto, and possibly it might have to be following someone like Alan Goldstein or Midori, you know, that they play something and then a student plays something. That didn't quite sit right with me. But at the same time, I felt very strongly that the 75th anniversary celebration had to be equally or more about our students, too. It wasn't just about these wonderful guests that we're going to learn from. So anyway, I thought about it and finally came up with this bizarre and crazy system whereby I found some piece of repertoire that every instrumentalist in the orchestra could potentially audition with, and it was going to be a concerto that was for violin and whatever else that instrument was. I mean, I even found something that would kind of work for tuba and violin. I mean, I just, you know, made sure that it was equitable, that everybody in the orchestra would have a chance. And sure enough, there was a lot of excitement. We had quite a lot of participants. Yes, as you pointed out, you were there listening to all of them and heard them all really play their hearts out trying for this wonderful chance to play with Midori. And in the event, the winner was one Anna Nordmo, who's a freshman right now. She's been in the orchestra already for 2 years. She got in as a seventh grader, very young age to get into the orchestra, but she's quite unusually gifted, I think. And I think you might agree, having heard her performance, that she really plays with a kind of maturity on the stage, and she has a real presence and point of view, I think, for someone so young. She already manages to really project these kinds of qualities in her playing.
On a practical standpoint, Anna had clearly memorized her part nearly completely and was able to interact with you as her partner for the audition.
That's right. At the audition, I was filling in for Midori with all the students, right?
Right. So it sort of gave one confidence that she could work on both levels. She wasn't just about knowing the music, but working with a great soloist as her partner.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's indeed why I wished to play with all the students and not, I mean, we might have just held the competition with just the students playing by themselves, and you could well imagine, you'd say, oh, well, this is a very fine performance, and I'm sure there'd be many very fine performances. But I thought it was a critical piece to say, well, and I should also say that these poor students had no chance for rehearsal with me. I just said, come on down and we're going to do this now in all this different repertoire. So, you know, we wanted to see really how did the students react? How was the depth of their knowledge of the piece sufficient enough that they were beyond simply getting through it and really at a point where they were, as you put it, communicating with me or giving me some ideas about what they thought about the music. And I think that's one way, memorized or not, that Anna was particularly successful at. I mean, I think she really had, like I said, a point of view. And I felt immediately as a partner with her on stage that I understood what it was she wanted to do. She sort of led me in the best sense possible. And I was able to sort of latch on to her conception of the piece and do something together with her.
Well, how does she feel now that it's only 3 or 4 days away?
I think she is elated and probably a little bit nervous. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure she was nervous for the competition, too. So that's part of our job as, you know, musicians to learn how to handle that and to harness it to something really, really great. And I have every confidence she'll be terrific.
Well, I've been brushing up a little on my Midori and playing a lot of recordings during the show for the last month or so. And one of the immediate qualities you get, especially of her latest Bach, solo Bach recording, is this warmth, this giving nature a beauty in her sound. I think you could almost feel that it would be an absolute delight to work with her, to play with her.
I think so. I'm saying this all, and she's, you know, just arriving in town now, and we'll have our first interactions with her tonight. But to the degree that you can hear a person in her sound, I think there's much to be excited about for our first rehearsal tonight.
Well, our next break here is of the finale to the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. So any thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I'll just say briefly that, of course, Anna and Midori will together play the last movement of the Bach Violin Concerto, or two violin concerto, which is an evergreen and really beloved work. And we're actually going to scale down the orchestra to just a small chamber-sized group. And one of our percussionists is a fine pianist, and he'll play the harpsichord. So we're really going to change I think the scope and the sound and really make it a very chamber-like feel for this performance. And I think it'll be really fun to do so.
I should remind folks that it's at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium this Sunday, and you can find full details at kalamazoojuniorsymphony.org or kjso.org.
Thank you. And after the Bach, we'll expand back out to the normal symphonic orchestra proportions and do this finale of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. There's always one anecdote that I think of when I think of the Violin Concerto. And I just love it so much because it's so hilariously mean. But the great Viennese music critic, Eduard Hanslick, heard the premiere of this piece because it was actually premiered in Vienna. I'll talk a little bit more in a second about why that is. But he said, listening to Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto presents us with the horrifying idea that music that can stink to the ear might exist. And then he called the finale the most odorously Russian of all of them.
That's terrible.
It was really mean. And all I can think of was when I read that is, well, I guess audiences have been just delighted to breathe it in ever since because it's great music. I mean, it is one of the most, I think, celebrated, and justly so, of violin concertos. It has a very expansive and generous and warm first movement, a really hauntingly beautiful second movement, and then the third movement is just goes for broke. I mean, it. I think of it as sort of bursting in on the scene because there's no proper end to the second movement as such, you know? It just suddenly dives in there and gets going. And after the violin solo seems for a second as if she is going to slow down the proceedings and calm down this energetic orchestral opening, really it's all just a lie. And with a wink, you know, she gets going on what seems like a practically perpetual motion. I mean, it's just blindingly fast. And I've heard recordings of Midori playing this, as we will shortly. And sure enough, it is just astonishingly fast. So we're going to be doing our best tonight to make sure that we keep up. And there's a second theme, which is, I think, exactly has the feeling of a hopak, this kind of Cossack folk dance, you know? And I think that's probably the bit that seemed odorously Russian, if you will. But, well, I love it. I think it's great stuff.
Let's hear it. That will be the crowd at Chenery Auditorium this Sunday afternoon at a concert featuring Midori as soloist and the winner of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra competition, also joining her in music of Bach. Here at WMUK is Andrew Kohler, who will be conducting the whole affair.
And joining the audience, I imagine, in that rapturous applause once Midori is finished.
It will be a very exciting moment. Midori is in Kalamazoo, or just arriving in Kalamazoo right now as we speak. And in fact, note to listeners, she will be my guest tomorrow morning on WMUK with conductor Raymond Harvey, because of course Midori is appearing with both orchestras, the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra Saturday night and the Junior Symphony on Sunday afternoon.
Exactly so.
You said she was very, very giving of her time, that her agenda was completely open to anybody who wanted to use and learn from her during her visit.
She's doing, I mean, it's just almost hour after hour, you know, she's doing teaching roundtables. She's playing at Western's convocation. She's doing a master class for students at Western. She's doing a master class for students in the community that's sponsored by the Stolberg competition. You know, obviously doing a lot of rehearsing with us, trying to cram in a little practice here and there, which she's very rightfully requested, and doing a lot of outreach concerts also with the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra string quartets. So, you know, our string quartets already have a habit of going out to schools, playing a little bit of what they do, showing that, you know, here they are colleagues of a similar age and they're able to do this really quite amazing stuff. And Midori will travel with them and kind of give maybe some input on how they might find new ways to engage these audiences.
In some ways, the young musicians of the Junior Symphony may have an advantage over this wonderful soloist Midori because they're used to the hall and how it sounds and what you've been practicing there. So they might be well prepared to have her join them.
I certainly hope that they will be well prepared.
I'm just hoping they can overcome their extreme excitement.
You know, I have full faith. Part of what the training of a musician is to do is under adverse and really exciting circumstances, to anything that might distract you, that we prepare ourselves to a point where we can still get the job done. You know, we can still do it. And then also be open to these conduits of inspiration and excitement, you know, and still let the hands, if you will, the breath, do what it needs to make the sound.
Now, how do you grow eyes in the back of your head to watch a soloist and keep an eye on your orchestra at the same time?
I find that it's actually quite easy. The better the soloist, the more, it's just like what we were talking about with Anna Nordmo, you know, I don't necessarily have to watch her to know. She shows with the way she plays, with the way she prepares sound, what her intentions are. And I know that will be the case with Midori. It will be, her point of view will be so clear that it'll be sort of an inexorable force. We'll have to go along with how she shapes this. And I think accompanying will probably be surprisingly straightforward. You know, she'll just sort of take charge of the proceedings.
Tickets for this concert will be available at the door, and you can find more information at KalamazooJuniorSymphony.org or KJSO.org. And the office number, is that 337-0440? That's Chenery Auditorium. They might be able to tell you more. Tickets are probably going fast for both concerts, and it's just a few more hours really for you to decide what to do with your weekend. So there you go. And there's just a few minutes left in this hour, so let's look at the Junior Symphony's performance of the Tchaikovsky Symphony number 4.
This is a work that dates from virtually the same time as the Violin Concerto, although they couldn't be more different in spirit. Tchaikovsky was, I think most scholars, there is still some controversy about this, I think most scholars would be very comfortable in saying that Tchaikovsky had homosexual tendencies, leanings, and attractions in his life. Unclear how much he was able to act upon them, but it was a very rigid social order, of course, in Imperial Russia at the time, and he felt the need to establish some kind of a cover, or, you know, just some sort of respectability by getting married. This was not a good choice for Tchaikovsky. It was a real disaster. His wife seemed not really cognizant of the situation. She really thought that, he married her because he loved her. And I think he really imagined the situation much more as a sort of a distraction, a social front to put up. In the event the marriage was a disaster, Tchaikovsky ended up running away to Western Europe for a year. And although they never officially divorced, they never again lived together. And Tchaikovsky felt a deep sense of guilt, both about his homosexuality, I think, but also about the way perhaps he had misled this woman. You know, I mean, he felt that it was somewhat unfair, and it was just a very messy business. So the Fourth Symphony is very much a product of this time, and the Violin Concerto is very much a product of the eventual emotional recuperation that he got to after spending some time in Western Europe. But the Fourth Symphony opens with what Tchaikovsky himself described as a fate motive. And this is, I think, what we'll have a chance to hear before the very somber first movement of this begins. This fate movement, as Tchaikovsky put it, is something that can't be fought, can't be avoided. One has to accept his fate. And there's a real powerful kind of inexorable pull of this very striking horn motive, and it returns several times throughout the symphony. And the rest of the movement is really caught up with a kind of waltz-like dance with this fate, a kind of resignation to submitting to this fate.
Andrew, thank you for coming in today, and all the best for Sunday's program.
Thank you so much, Kara.